Last week, you guys were on fire. We were discussing GW's best game, and one of you guys has won a copy of Tooth and Claw. Wait for a little bit later in the show, we'll tell you who won it. This week, I'm giving away two of these. This is Night Vault for Warhammer Underworlds, the next one after Shadespire. If you want to be in with a chance of winning one of these, be sure to comment, like, and subscribe. And Lance has also told me to remind you to ding my dong. Yeah, we're busy with stuff too. So before we get into it, let me just show you. We're in the final run to building up to the Bolt Action Desert War Boot Camp. So if you follow us over on beastsofwar.com or on tabletop.com, they both go to the same place, you'll be able to keep up with some of the stuff we're doing. So we're building city tables. We're going through into what's going to become an old fort with a British encampment. And then the cool one, the really cool one. We've been building, and this is all vlogged on beastsofwar.com, we've been building a massive desert trench works. So whether you've got your bolt action or your Imperial Guard, I reckon you could probably have some fun on something like that. And then finally, about those comments last week, they were so good, we had to get a cat to tell us what you were doing. Want to know what that's all about? Watch the show. Welcome to the show. Did I mention that we're giving away Warhammer Underworld's Night Vault? Remember, to be in with a chance of winning it, it's easy peasy. Just get involved in the discussion today. Or just type win. And remember to hit that like button and to subscribe. And you'll be in with a chance of winning Night Vault. If you want an extra chance, okay? Uh-huh. Now bugger this, I'm going to give away two copies, okay? I'm going to give away two copies. If you want to be in with an extra chance of winning this as well, come on over to beastsofwar.com, set yourself up a free account, and come into this post on the platform and post a comment there as well. And while you're at it, go and check out our project system, our places. Yeah. We have loads and loads of cool tools and great forums. You will have a blast here. I'm going to rate some games. We've got these gorgeous... Lance, show them the little stars that we do for rating games.
Ding, ding, ding.
It's cool. It's cool. Come on across. Right. Man, I'm going to show that picture again. We need to see the Kill Team Cat. Bring up the Kill Team Cat.
There is indeed no Kill Team Cat.
This is the Kill Team Cat. This is all the f***ing evidence you guys will ever need that Mass Battle is dying on its ass.
Oh, that's a statement.
It is a statement. To be fair, there are some caveats to this. Today's discussion is about, are the Mass Battle games dead? Now, I will preface this by saying, yes, We're basing our conclusions on your comments from last week. Mm-hmm. There is no scientific evidence for it, but it is a scientific fact.
Right. Are we counting Apocalypse as Mass Battle?
Yes, all of that.
Okay.
The reason is, maybe last week's question was a little bit loaded, but we did include 40K and Age of Sigmar in our overview last week. But what utterly surprised me was the response. Kill team, kill team, kill team, kill team, kill team, kill team. Mm. Bring up the Kill Team Cat. Because I know that every time we bring up this f***ing cat, we're going to get more likes than we've ever had on a video on Beast of War ever before. So what else can you spot in there? Like, get 40K Kill Team.
Team one
no. You know, it's new. I see Claw in there. I see...
For all of much, guys. Soul. Well, Team one no.
Rules.
Rules. You know, it's...
Let get 40K.
I'm disappointed, Justin. Not I don't see. Look I don't see dignity in there new. Or Warzone in there.
No,
it's yeah. It's so clearly. Whenever we put the call out as to what do you think is the best game out there, you just gravitated towards Kill Team, and it wasn't only Kill Team, Lloyd. There was Kill Team in there. There was Necromunda in there. There was a load of guys that just did not get the question at all and went back into the annals of history to pull out all the games that aren't currently made, the Space Hulks and stuff.
We had that discussion before we went to filming as to whether or not to include those.
And that's fine. That's fine. You know, it all added to the texture of a wonderful conversation. But it wasn't the question.
It didn't rule you out of the prizes, though. I remember at the end of this show, we'll be announcing who will get the. Is it Tooth and Claw we call it?
Yes,
Tooth and Claw.
Tooth and Tooth and
Claw.
Claw. Oh, you're going to be so happy. You're going to be jammy dancing like
Well,
nothing
don't
else.
forget, it was either Tooth and Claw or their choice of the starter set. So depending on who's won, it could be Tooth and Claw or something else.
You're getting Tooth and Claw. I've just checked. I've just checked. So the thing about this is, here we are with another game.
Yes.
Okay, this is a part. This is Warhammer Underworld. So this is the next part of that. It comes after Shadespire.
Yeah.
This is Games Workshop's kind of their take on the ultimate kind of competitive play
Yeah,
game.
this is arena combat within the Age of Sigmar universe.
Now, the minis in this are
They're
lovely.
gorgeous, yeah.
You will find out more about that in a separate video because we can't show you any more of this than this during this particular video. But we can still give away the two copies of it. But
I wish I'd looked in the box before I sat down, though.
has the community really moved away from mass battle? Because surely we still gravitate towards having that wonderful 40K army that just.
It's a shift we've seen in the industry, though, and something that I think we ourselves as a company may have influenced slightly, is so many people play so many game systems these days. These game systems have to be tighter, lighter, and easier to remember on the fly. Because if I put this down and don't play it for 6 months, I want to be able to pick it up and remember sort of how to play and just have to refinesse myself.
Dude, I thought you were going to go for the triple and you were going to make it tighter, lighter, fighter. I don't know what you were going to put in there, but I thought you were going to come out with something just
Oh no,
epic.
my
T-shirt level material.
No, my tagline, I am tired right now. I'm tired, so my brain is basically operating on about 70% power, so I'm just good enough to do an XL, a weekender and an XLBS, but you're not going to get anything super special out of me.
There's definitely a trend towards smaller games, skirmish games,
Board
not mass
games.
battle. And one of the things I've watched recently is on game days in here, we game on a Sunday.
Yeah.
Some people come in and they've never gamed before,
yeah.
and they'll keep coming week after week, but they will never, what's the word?
Make
They'll
the
never
leap.
commit to anything,
Yeah.
right? They'll look at a Kings of War army with like loads of miniatures, or a massive 40K army, or whatever, you know, those really big ones,
Yeah.
and they'll never ever commit to it. Because you just look at it and go,
I couldn't
"Pfft,
do
I
it.
couldn't do that."
Yeah,
Yeah.
but
But
there's an intimidation level to that as well. There's so much to do. You know, it's one thing 40K tried to stop happening whenever they did that small scale starter that you could just expand out, and it's what they're doing with their Conquest set at the minute as well. That part works that they're doing, which I
Yeah,
think
the
is
likes of
genius.
Kill Team, I think, is a really good move.
Yeah.
I was talking about it a few months ago when it came out, and I was like, "Oh, this could be the way in for a lot of people."
Yeah.
I don't know if that is,
Oh, it
but
clearly is.
there's been a fella come into the club for months. Okay, never really committed to anything. I said, "Well, what about Saga? What about this? What about that?" And his answer was always, "Well, I haven't yet tried enough game systems to want to actually commit to anything." Okay, but just last week, there was a picture one up on Facebook. He went into the news agents and went home
Conquest.
With Conquest, the first edition of it.
I think that is a genius move. Having a Parts Works to get two fully painted armies on the tabletop, you have a nice staged run of development where you can get a big force at the end without realizing just how much work you're putting into
What
it.
does it build up to? Does it build up to kill team armies or
You
what is it?
get two entire armies at the
Yeah,
end of
two
it. If
full
you look at the massive thing you get, it's like a huge Space Marine force and a huge Nurgle Death Guard force, I think.
So it
As
gives
well
you
as
up.
terrain and everything too.
It gives you up towards a proper full-on 40K sized army then, does it?
Yeah.
But they've broken
But
it down into chunks that's acceptable.
yeah,
yeah.
Rather,
It's
because I even gave the fella a Viking Warband. I had sprues sitting around that I didn't need
Yeah.
anymore. I gave that to him. But this Conquest thing has been bought and put on Facebook. I haven't seen if he's done anything with the Vikings yet. But it's because he's maybe been served that piecemeal. Oh, I can tackle this, rather than me going, "There's 50 Vikings for you."
Yeah.
There's
But
also the investment of it. You don't see yourself spending maybe £1,000 on an army because it's only like, here's a tenner a month, here's a tenner a month, here's a tenner a month until you're done.
I was going to say, I think the thing though that's really important at this point is that even though a lot of people are seeing maybe, for example, Kill Team as this starting point for them to get stuck into a larger game of 40K, they're not doing that. They're
Yeah.
sitting and they're thinking immediately, "Well, Kill Team is a pretty awesome rule set," or they're going, "Necromunda rules," or "Battle Companies is excellent." I'll just sit and play this because it's easier. I can go and buy another warband very, very easily and quickly.
Yep.
Yeah.
Why bother buying a huge army when I can have exactly the same amount of fun in the 40k universe mm-hmm. playing something like Kill Team?
And it's simpler to draw in a friend by saying, yeah, just get yourself 10 models, paint them up, we're off we go.
Yeah, this is what I'm wondering. It does Kill Team sufficiently scratch the itch? You know, because what Kill Team gives you is it gives you immense flexibility,
mm-hmm.
you know, because creating your Kill Team warbands, you know, you're just picking bits and pieces from right across the 40k range.
Yeah,
you know, creating Kill Team warbands is massively more accessible than creating 40k, you know, 40k armies that you're going to fully enjoy the 40k experience.
Games Workshop have given you pre-built sets for the factions, so you're not having to go out and buy like a £30 box and another £30 box to make it.
So, if I bring like profitability into it, you might think, oh, well, if they're not buying full 40k armies, Games Workshop will run out of stuff to sell them pretty quickly. But when you go down that route of going, well, it's easy enough to get a warband up and running, people will start going, well, I'll have this warband.
Yeah.
And now I'll have that warband. Mm-hmm. Because, and they don't feel like they're stuck in one army and have to keep collecting that army forever.
Mm-hmm.
They hit a point that's naturally, right, that's a big enough army for Kill Team. It sort of breaks down after that. You would be into 40k. I won't collect any more of that, but I will start another warband because I've enjoyed the whole process and I want all the flavors of trying different stuff.
Yeah. The only thing I think is missing, and I saw it in another game recently, is an AI system that would run an opposing warband against you.
Yeah.
Now, I saw this recently in Fallout Wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
It allows me to buy every single item from the range. I don't even need a friend. I can play it against myself.
That was made for you, man.
The funny thing is, the AI in that game feels like I'm playing me. I kid you not. It is vicious.
What you mean it's all cardboard?
Okay, I'm not going to flip him off on camera. The hand went up, the finger was ready to extend, but I'm not going to do it.
Oh God, Justin!
Can you hear yourself talking to yourself in your planet?
The way the game plays against
cardboard, Justin! How dare you have done that? That's so cheesy, cardboard, Justin.
I tell you what, play the game. I will show you how to play the game, and you'll see what I mean.
How far off do you think it is? Then the thing about it is, does Kill Team, does anything in the 40k universe really require solo play whenever it's so massively available?
I'm looking at it as a good way to give you that excuse that you always loved whenever you had Warhammer Quest, to buy everything.
Yeah.
I don't think the solo thing is that important when you come down to like the Kill Team, because more players can dip into it quickly.
Yeah.
When it comes to solo stuff, like I'm going to veer off slightly. For example, for myself, what I find myself doing in the evenings is I just find myself making my army bigger. Mm. So I'm kind of bucking the trend a little bit because I've went into the saga, which you start off with a relatively small army, and now I'm just ballooning it out. So I'm kind of going the other way, where I've started with a small warband and I'm working my nuts off to make a massive army because I want a mass army.
I also wonder if the user base that Fallout is pitched at, if an AI deck, you know, and solo
it's not
play.
An AI deck. Each unit has its own AI card, which determines, depending on what its status is within the game, what it's going to do.
Yeah, well, the solo play. Let's say, did solo play become a kind of like a key component of that? Because Fallout itself is a fairly heavily solo played game.
Honestly,
so in other words, to appeal to Fallout players who maybe aren't in the hobby.
I'm with you on this.
Yeah, maybe that was a good move in that instance.
This is an IP.
The game we played was actually a co-op game.
Mm-hmm.
So two human players versus the AI.
Yes, but you were still versing someone else rather
No. It was us playing co-op against the AI.
Yes, but you and your mate were against something.
Yeah.
Mm.
But you can play a versus game where it acts as a third player.
I get your point on this because I think you're right that versus mode against the AI very much sort of recreates the video game experience for those who are used to video games.
Possibly.
Yeah.
And not having to go out and find another opponent, a real life opponent to sit and actually have to have a game.
Possibly.
Well, you know, let's look at our industry. You know, is what I'm looking at here with Night Vault, is this the video gaming influence coming into our industry where people, like, when you're a video gamer, right? You buy the video games, and the new video game comes out, and you buy it, and you trade off the old one, and you buy the next one. And each one is a self-contained product that you fully enjoy, and you're not wondering too much about committing to a massive hobby. Your hobby is the video games.
For this, I would say yes.
Has that generation now come back or come into our industry? What is driving this? If it's a desire to play a larger variety of games, then that's one thing. Is it a desire to spend less on the games?
I think a lot of these games are a response from companies like Games Workshop, and we're seeing it in other companies as well, to people just not having the time to do what they used to do, I think.
Yeah,
I think in a society now where things are going quicker and faster, and you want to do more stuff and try and pack more things into a day, loving 40K and Warhammer 40,000 and the world behind it, and having a game like Kill Team to dive into is a much more accessible and enjoyable process and prospect than diving into 40K proper and collecting a huge army of Space Marines, for example, when you can do, as we've said already, just sit down and play Kill Team, and the game is over in half an hour, 45 minutes.
And the fact
that all the stuff that you're making is your own as well, which is really cool. Yeah. So you've got your own characters and things like that. I think another big part of it as well, just to sort of go off on a little bit of a tangent, is that in actual fact, playing smaller games like Kill Team or Warhammer Underworlds and their games there, like Shadespire and Night Vault, allow you to go back to a lot of things that hobbyists were enjoying back in the day that I think maybe we've lost a little bit more now. We're getting to do things like bits boxing and kit bashing and that kind of thing, just to add things to your force. And whereas before, an army, like a 1,000-point army for Space Marines, for example, maybe was like 30 models, 40 models, now it's lots more than that. Coming to something like Kill Team, picking up 10, 15 models, painting those up, making them how you want, using things from other sprues and stuff, a lot more enjoyable for a lot of hobbyists and painters as well as gamers.
On the smaller scales, you really can go to town on how you customize an army with your conversions and things. Yeah. And
some of this smaller box set stuff, though, is when we're talking about what's driving it. Mm. If you look at modern society, we're very used to entertaining ourselves instantaneously.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, with Netflix and Amazon and stuff, it's not just that you can watch it instantaneously. You can stop it and go watch something else, watch something else.
This is entirely correct, because I noticed recently that I wanted to watch Lord of the Rings with my children, right? And I nearly watched something else because I couldn't be asked getting off my backside to go and get the Blu-ray. In fact, I nearly went to Amazon Prime and spent a tenner to buy the movie that I already had on Blu-ray because I couldn't be arsed getting up to go and get it. And I thought to myself, oh, but it'd be so handy to have it on.
Yeah.
I have done that. I have bought disc-based video games and then rebought it as digital.
I was going to say, I'll tell you how lazy I have felt. Over the last week, I was on holiday, and we couldn't find the way to press play on the remote. So I had to get up and walk over to the DVD player to press play, and I felt exhausted every single time I did that. So just how obnoxious we are now.
Dude, that took you back. Like, I remember as a child, us actually having to do that.
Oh, yeah, I had to do that.
Man, I remember an old TV my grandma's, you had to tune it like a radio.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it makes me wonder, like, it could just be a reflection of modern society. I don't know if it's a good reflection of modern society in so much as nothing seems to hold our interest for very long.
Yeah. Well, that's
like when you were a kid, you'd get like a toy. Mm. And you'd have to play with it until it broke.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That was it.
Yeah. Well, this is a discussion we had a while back about the lifespan of games that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
That cycle that people go through. They'll play, they'll dip into the world, and then they're off to the next new thing.
Which this makes me believe that there's few companies out there who are better placed than Games Workshop to feed that need and to be able to feed that desire. And
that's what this does.
These guys are on fire. You know, this
gives you the
incredible
reason to revisit
strategy.
It gives you enough to have the same experience amount-wise as you had with the first Shadespire box, but you could take this and combine it with Shadespire, and you're getting even more playtime out of it.
But
so they're getting you to spend more time
with
it.
I was going to say, like, another aspect of this that I haven't actually thought about until just now is that I have been playing Age of Sigmar Champions, right? And that is an ideal way for me to play the mass battle game of Age of Sigmar without actually having to buy any models.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I've just been playing Champions and being like, I sat down to my friend and I was like, you know what? I can actually collect a Stormcast Eternals Force and I don't have to buy a single piece of plastic. I was like, and the game again for that is over in half an hour.
So but do you get a sense of fulfillment from that? Like, I've got to say, because
I'm experiencing the world. Like, I love the Age of Sigmar world, and I think it's a fantastic thing that they've created here with the Mortal Realms and stuff. But I can't be bothered to buy all the models for it. Whereas I can actually say to myself, you know what? I can actually delve into the Idoneth Deepkin and try out an army for them. But now I can just do it in card form rather than playing a big, huge mass battle game with loads of plastic.
Minis are a big thing for me. If the minis are pretty in a new product, I will generally go for it.
Even at a mass battle scale, though, would you say that you dive into something as big as Age of Sigmar if you love the armies?
If there was an army that caught my attention, I would go for a dip into it. I've done it before. I've bought starter sets into factions, but not went all the way into them.
Yeah.
Just to have the pretty minis.
But what if that army had something as like a small sort of side thing, like an Age of Sigmar skirmish or a Warhammer Underworlds faction? Would you prefer to just maybe buy that instead, rather than buying for the army?
You have those starter forces in Games Workshop for each of the armies, yeah? For me, if I see it and I love the miniatures, I'll grab that. I might buy nothing else for the faction. I might never play with it.
Yeah.
But if the models are pretty in a starter set, I don't mind picking it up just to have them for me to enjoy the experience of building and trying to paint and feeling to paint.
But the interesting thing there, I think, is that if you went and bought one of those start sets, I think for a lot of people, you might sit down and think, well, actually, I'm not going to really get as much out of this. Maybe you do, but I'm not going to get as much out of this because I feel I should be playing the large game of Age of Sigmar. Mm. Where if you, for example, had, let's just say for the sake of argument, an Idoneth Deepkin Warhammer Underworld set, that you could have bought and then say, well, actually, I can buy this and I can still play with it. Mm. I think a lot more people would get more out of that and that immediacy than going and buying a box set, for example, and then not doing anything with it. So I think that's a big draw for smaller stuff.
It depends on the aspects of the hobby that you really love. For me, I have always, my favorite part of the hobby has always been that initial buy moment when you buy something new, you pull it out of the box, you're clipping it off the screw, gluing it together, you have the smell of the glue, you prime it, and then it sits on a shelf.
Yeah.
You see, Games Workshop are well placed to do this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. They have the infrastructure there.
If we talk about fulfillment,
yeah.
Do you feel fulfilled, right? I think you were going to talk about video games don't really make you feel fulfilled.
A lot of them can give you that sense of achievement, though.
The thing about it is, it's about there comes a point in our hobby where you will choose a deeper part of the hobby. Okay, so for Lloyd, that has become Saga, and he's enjoying the historicals on that. Mm-hmm. For me, at one point it was Flames of War. Mm-hmm. You know, so for me. Coming up soon, and this is why I was aghast by this. I couldn't believe it when the Kill Team Cat rendered out, and I saw that. You know, it's to give you some perspective. Just once again to recap, bring up the Kill Team Cat. Kill Team Cat was, we took your comments and we ran it through the Kill Team Catinator, and basically what it does is it looked at all your comments and it read it, and then the words that were most used, it made big. In the shape of a cat.
How many times did law have to get used to make it in there?
Law?
L-A-W. It's right there at the tail.
Oh, so it is. No, that's claw, Justin.
Claw, I can't be cursive, I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's claw at the tail, there's soul, there's looking, there's recently, there's rules, there's AOS, there's make, really, dark, choice, trade... traders, work, way, armies. It's all in there.
See, value.
Value.
Yeah.
So I was astounded by this. I was not expecting it to be so much more popular. But when the comments started to come in, what I saw, and what you guys will see if you go back and look at it, is not only, there was a number of categories of people all gravitating towards Kill Team. Yeah. There were returning veterans.
Yeah.
So returning veteran gamers who are all gravitating towards Kill Team.
That doesn't surprise me. I'll come back to it in a sec. But as soon as I seen the Kill Team box sets coming in, if I wasn't in the middle of a project, I was very tempted to just go, give me it.
New players. The number of new players that commented and said, "I'm just getting into it, and I'm loving Kill Team."
It's that accessibility thing. You buy one box, off you go. You're not looking at down the barrel spending maybe 700-800 quid to get a force.
This is what this guy was talking about at the club needs to go into. He needs to go in the kill team because he's been holding off saying, I want to get into 40k. I wanted to get into 40k. I think I said in passing in kill team. The next time I see him, I'll say, you really need to find someone to play kill team with.
And then existing players. Existing players who never actually left, who have always been there, seem to be gravitating towards kill team because it gives them the flexibility of play styles and a flexibility of collecting that previously they may not have had.
It lets them cherry pick characters from their big armies that they maybe already own. Then that brings the narrative to the tabletop. This guy from this squad, he's a total hero. I had him in kill team and he did this.
It's left me wondering where to go, because once we get the boot camp out of our hair, I've been looking to get back onto the Astral Knights. I have this deep and enduring love of the Astral Knights, and we have the beginnings of an Astral Knights force here, and I want to get more into the background of it and really look to expand that army out and see. But it kind of shocked me because I was looking at it, and I'm still of the mode of old school 40k. I'm looking forward to getting my big vehicles in there, getting my diversity of units in there.
It's all dead. It's all dead, Dave.
What am I going to do? I'm going to pick five guys?
I think you can't say it's dead, but definitely the market has diversified a hell of a lot. That hardcore player base has been diluted.
Is it temporary? Is it a case of...
But is it game... Is it genre specific? Like, let's go for historicals. Has the big games died out of historicals?
Well, Saga played a part in doing that, as did Bolt Action.
It certainly stripped it down to about 50 minis.
Saga and Bolt Action, I think, had a huge impact on the play style within the historicals market.
And you've got tanks. This is kind of a pick-up-and-go game.
Yeah, tanks is very pick-up-and-go as well.
But you do still have Flames of War and Team Yankee out there if you want to do big battles at 15 mil. But that's a different kettle of fish because perhaps the different skill makes it an easier proposition
Smaller scale and less real estate of models on the table is the big thing there. Like, that when you're dealing with that, you're dealing with handfuls of tanks, not regiments and regiments of men, I think is the key.
Dudes, I'm imploring you, if you can find it in your heart in the comments to say, Warzone, you're not alone, man. Your desire to have land raiders and land speeders and predators and rhinos all back on the tabletop is not abnormal in this day and age.
We need to get you the new grav tank.
It makes my blood run a little bit cold if I'm thinking that my Astral Knights will only be there in a group of a half a dozen guys doing their thing. I want to see the big-ass army going out, and I want to build it.
I wouldn't worry about it too much because there's trends. Mm. You know, trends come and go. Like, let's say there's Kill Team now, and these smaller box games bring in a load of players. Surely it's not hard to conceive that maybe in a few years' time they'll be like, well, I'm collecting more and more stuff. Yep. Now I need to play a game that lets me use all my stuff.
Well, we were there. We were there back in 2008, 2009, because we were all there with our 40K armies, and then Apocalypse came out. Wanted to use all your models. 40K wasn't even big enough. Mm-hmm. Who plays Apocalypse now?
There are groups on Facebook. There was one, John's friend Leiden. Uh-huh. I think we mentioned it ages ago. They had a Titan battle where their gaming space, I think, was about 13 by 24 feet.
Yeah, they did it so they could field their Titans.
Yeah.
They didn't do it so they could field 1,000 miniatures.
Yeah, but let's be honest. Apocalypse takes the piss.
Yeah, it does take the piss.
It's like having a wee itch and cutting your hand off to solve it. Yeah. It's like way over on the extreme.
Well, I do remember seeing
it. Takes the piss in a beautiful way, Lloyd.
Yes, it's an extremely beautiful way.
I will never forget the time I bought 9 drop pods.
But never underestimate the appeal of wanting a mass army.
Mm. Yes.
Because everything I've got, like I've got Vikings, I'm buying, so I've got like Vikings from...
Mars.
Now I've got a Footsore Vikings Warband.
Yes.
I've got Dom's Vikings from Griffin Beast to do.
Yeah.
I've got some more Fireforge Swedish guys hanging about.
Yeah.
I'm kitbashing like 12 guys, but I'm going to base them all the same because I'm going to pull it all together into one mass army.
So like a Viking, like a Viking allied horde of hell.
The great heathen army.
Because I'm building up towards it, and the way I'm building up towards it isn't going to have my my Ross army, mm-hmm. and then I'm going to have my Viking army, mm-hmm. and then I'm going to have my John's Vikings army, mm-hmm. but they're all going to be based the same.
John's so
Viking
can...
army. Yeah, John's Viking army. John's
Viking. So, or John's, or what the hell I have.
It's Yom's.
Yom's, that's Yom's. It. Yom's. I just call him Yom's. I want my Yom's. But anyway, I'm going to stick the Yom's and everyone together. Mm. All, yeah. Same base and style, but whack it all together and go, bang, there's my mass army. Because I want a mass army. I do.
Yeah.
And I think people who get into this will enjoy it.
You think that they'll get
there. They'll get that itch.
Uh-huh.
Well, I do wonder the miniatures from in here have a corresponding profile in Age of Sigmar. That I don't know.
Well, wait. No, here's the thing.
They will
right?
do eventually.
Yeah. The itch. Right, let's talk about the itch. The grandfather, well, obviously Donald Weatherstone, but the younger grandfather, the younger and better looking and lovely grandfather of modern wargaming, John Stallard, talks about the collector's gene, okay? Mm-hmm. That once the collector's gene grabs a hold of you, there is no letting go. But here's my counter to your point, Lloyd. Yeah, they could buy Night Vault and they could say, I absolutely want to do Age of Sigmar on the big scale, okay? Yeah. Or they could buy Night Vault and then just say, oh, I love that. And then they just buy the next Night Vault and then the next Night Vault and they never gravitate up to the big army.
But because Games Workshop keep making these, they don't have to. They're still going to spend money with Games Workshop and the price point on these is just good.
That's right.
But they're making my Astral Knights redundant.
That's where buying into a particular world is good. If they keep doing this, mm-hmm. you will get fulfillment out of it because it's not a case of you jump from one game system over and over and over again. You everything that you've put on your shelf, you can look at it and go, if it's not one mass army, it's all one mass universe, and it all relates to each other.
You also have the thing that what Age of Sigmar explores within that universe is not the same as what this explores within the universe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've said it before, the first time I read the story for Necromunda, it was a part of the world I had never really seen, never really understood the scale of before.
Yeah.
And that was a window into it that I never had. So as you get more into it, you're going to be curious about what are the other aspects of this world that my friends keep talking about and I keep hearing about. So that might tempt you into maybe jumping into the bigger battle stuff as well. This is your
I'm curious about how long my Land Raider is going to survive on the tabletop and how far into deep enemy territory I can get piss off my opponent, man.
You used to be the fluffy narrative gamer in here. You sound bitter and cheesy right now.
The Land Raider is the epitome of fluff, man. It is just a beautiful, beautiful thing.
You've seen the grab tank, yeah.
My worry about the kill team trend is that we start to lose the real beautiful landmark components of what made these armies magnificent. And I want to see magnificent armies, guys. I don't want to lose the prospect of seeing magnificent armies. And it would be a crime for many hobbyists. Not all. We're not all in the position and not everybody's going to enjoy it. But wouldn't it be a crime for a hobbyist who to miss out on that when they could just truly love it?
But tell me, Warren, you don't want one of these?
No, don't want one.
You don't
of those.
Like those?
No, I don't. I'm not. What's wrong with that? I'm not a fan. I'm just not a fan.
I don't.
Give me a proper Land Raider with tracks day.
I'm not too worried about it. I mean, you could be painting like the skeletons and stuff in that, the ghosts and things like that.
Yeah.
And when you get to the end of it, you're going, that was that's cool. That's a good result. I fancy a bit more of that.
Yeah.
Because you'll find you might fall into a comfort zone where you go, I know how to do this.
There you go, Warren. There's your baby.
I know how to do this. Now I'm just going to do more of it.
Look at that. Look at that thing in its beauty. And that's not even a pretty one. You get even... Oh, just look at it.
You see, that's how people end up with massive armies.
Yeah.
It's like they've been painting a color scheme. They're used to it. They know how it works. Mm. They've invested in it. And it kind of just snowballs. Maybe you go home one evening. You want to paint, but you don't want to stress yourself too much. You just fall into a comfort zone of, oh, I know what I'm doing. I'll just do more of that.
Dudes, I'm passing it over to you, right? This is the big topic of conversation this week. This, just a simple comment could win you a copy of Night Vault.
And we have two to give away.
So remember, hit like, hit subscribe, come over to Beast of War, post a free comment in there with two of these that we're giving away. Because next week, I hope beyond hope that we will no longer have the Kill Team Cat. We will have the 40k big
shiny
ass army cat. When everybody comes in and goes, yeah, Warzone, don't you worry, man.
No.
I want a big ass 40k army.
Don't worry.
I want a big ass 40k army.
It's a cat. You know exactly what's going to happen. Just the biggest word in the middle of it is going to be no.
Oh, no.
But will it not not be will it not be just a cat that says, I want to win Night Vault?
the pick me cat. Pick me. It's not only Workshop that's doing it. Let me put this beautiful Night Vault away that you could win by simply commenting, liking, and subscribing. All right. Okay, it's not only Night Vault. Kings of War is doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Ben, time to talk about the news.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So the first little bit of news here is the one that you were just alluding to there, is that Mantic Games have put all their pre-orders up for Kings of War Vanguard, which is the small skirmish-based elements of the Worlds of Kings of War that they took to Kickstarter not too long ago as well, actually.
Yeah.
So some of the starter sets you can pick up that they've actually got attached to the site are the likes of the Basileans, the Abyssals, the Northern Alliance, and the Nightstalkers, which are a new faction within the world of Mantica. Although, of course, because it's Kings of War Vanguard, you can use models from pretty much any of the armies and just bung them down together, a little bit like Kill Team kind of thing, where you're picking up your favorite characters and using them for what Ronnie has said in the video as the Black Ops of Kings of War. So
Black Ops of Kings of War.
You're going to be playing as war bands of elite warriors that are heading out at the front of an army, like a Vanguard, as you might imagine, doing the scouting missions, the assassinations, the destroying of supply lines, and things like that. All of the stuff is up there for pre-order right now. They've also got a free rulebook download, so you can actually check out the rules for themselves, as well as I think it's maybe one or two different scenarios in there as well. So you can give the game a go if you want, and then go and pick up the book as well if you want to later, if you want to carry it on and stuff like that. One of the big things about this is it's got a campaign mode built into it as well, which is really cool. Jerry was talking about that a little bit in the comments, going through how that's going to be drawing people into it. But yeah, as we were saying at the beginning of this, this could be another one of these big signs that skirmish gaming is the way forward. And it's all this kind of thing is drawing people towards these smaller scale games on the tabletop because they add a little bit more narrative and add a little bit more story to the games they're playing.
And you get to buy the biggest ass giant that I have ever seen.
There is also a massive, huge plastic giant. Yes, that is a big, huge plastic giant. And I believe, I can't remember whether or not it was Kickstarter exclusive or whether or not it's actually going to be sold separately, but there was also like a Frost Giant expansion in resin.
I hope it's sold separately because the giant's like the standout thing for me.
Oh, I love the giant.
It's just head and shoulders above the rest.
Look at this. I am really digging this Northern Alliance stuff. It's got a really cool style to it.
Yeah. I like the Yetis. Yeah, the Yetis are very cool.
I'm also going to say, for all those people that were complaining that the giant was too big, it's a giant.
It is a giant. Yeah, it is a giant.
How can a giant be too big?
Mind you, I can absolutely see us employ John into getting an Action Man and a Barbie doll and doing some sort of a conversion work on that.
doesn't that bring us back to our
careful. We don't talk about that.
Oh,
we don't talk about Fight Club. The early days of Beasts of War are just between us and those that experienced it firsthand. Toon Realms by Lucid Eye.
Yeah, so we've been talking a little bit about sort of getting younger gamers into tabletop wargaming and sort of role-playing and skirmish games too, and Lucid Eye are doing exactly that with what's called their Toon Realms range. Now, I believe there may be a game in the works for this, which would be very, very cool indeed, but the vast majority of the models that you can see here are a bunch of characters and troops and monsters that you can use for playing dungeon delves, skirmish games, and all sorts of things like that. All of the models are very, very easy to put together. They're all one-piece models, which is pretty awesome. And each of the models themselves has really nice big surface areas for them. So if you're getting someone started painting, these seem like a very, 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 very good idea.
I really like these.
I was thinking these would be very, very cool for younger gamers. Maybe if your family wants to get involved with painting some models and stuff, these are a very, very good idea for them to get stuck into that and learning techniques and stuff too. It's also good for big kids. I really like the idea of painting up some of the characters for this. I think they'd be very, very cool, especially for use in board games and stuff too. So, really enjoying what they're doing here. And hopefully we do see a game come out for this as well. Although it's not entirely needed. No, not every range needs a game these days.
Exactly. They're cool. I like the style and the stuff, but I find it hard to accept repeats. Something,
but a child doesn't.
No, a child doesn't.
No, no.
Like when we were kids, we had repeats in the Hero Quest box, and it never affected us at all. You know, we were looking at some of these things through an adult eye. I'm going to talk tomorrow in the podcast I'm designing and working on an RPG dungeon crawling process with my own children. I've got some cool stuff to show you tomorrow on that. But I'm quite taken with these because of their simplicity. You know, the fact that they're easy to build because they're one piece.
No, no, no.
I realise what I'd said exactly as I said. They're so easy to build. You don't need to build.
But the One Piece thing does appeal to me because your little hands don't have the dexterity to do that.
Oh, One Piece is great. Mm.
So get them, prime them, and then set them down with some crazy paintbrushes and let them chuck colour on it.
I guess for kids, yeah, but you can't get rangers that are One Pieces and everything's an individual sculpt.
Yeah.
Which is like, oh, London, just amazing.
London does that, don't they? So,
yeah, and I'm with you on this, Ben. I don't think Outrange necessarily needs a game. Mm. You know, I'd be quite happy to gather some of that and use it in an RPG or something like that with the children. So
one of the things that came up actually through social media and as well through the comments as well was a lot of people were saying this would be great for people trying to do an alternative take on HeroQuest.
Yes.
Because they all seem like they fit into that sort of mold, so use them for games of HeroQuest. And a lot of people were saying over on Facebook and stuff that they've been using them to teach Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing to their kids, which is very cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a cool idea.
Blood Red Skies has zoomed over to the Pacific.
This makes me happy.
Very nice stuff here, Ben.
Yeah, so we've got two new stories about Blood Red Skies. But the first one is, as you say, over in the Pacific with some island hopping. And this is the introduction of the F4F Wildcat, which are very cool. So you've got a new set of these, which are done in metals, I believe, which is really neat. And of course, you're going to also have some forces for them to come up against. So you've got the Japanese with the Nakajima B5N Kate Squadron Torpedo Bombers, which are very cool.
Yeah.
The interesting thing I learned when I was reading a little bit more about these is that both of these planes were considered to be not very good. So it seems like it was all a comedy of errors for everybody when it came to the Pacific and stuff like that. I'm sure that Ariskany is going to correct me on some of these, but everyone seems to consider that the Nakajima Kate squadrons and those torpedo bombers just weren't very good, but they kind of did their job.
Yeah.
Same for the Wildcats as well. One of the really cool things actually is that obviously Blood Red Skies throws into the mix some ace pilots. And one of the ace pilots for the Wildcats is Joseph J. Foss, who you can see there in some of the nice artwork too. And he was in charge of what was called Foss's Flying Circus, so they made quite a name for themselves at the Battle of the Guadalcanal, which is really cool. But yeah, some really nice stuff sort of going off in a different direction. It was very, very interesting, however, reading through the comments with a lot of people saying, "Ah, thank God, I can stop collecting Blood Red Skies because it's not in Europe, it's over in America now." And then lots of other people saying, "Thank God, they're bringing the Americans into the mix.
So I can start collecting Blood Red Skies." Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
It's a super superb game. It's a superb game. We've had such a blast.
I really want to play. Guys.
Well, for me, the excitement for this is we now have more aircraft types, so we can do mixed squadrons and actually start getting some different special rules on the go.
Mm-hmm.
So that's got me excited.
Yeah, the other really cool thing as well is that they also announced this week that they're also going to be bringing out the Hurricanes and the Mosquitoes, as well as a whole range of flying aces for the British. So if you want to get stuck into more of your Battle of Britain stuff, you've got some really cool things coming together over there. Again, with what's happening with the stuff we saw for the US, we're going to have a load of ace pilots. So you've got some really nice character developing in these, and it also allows you to delve a little bit more into the background, learn a bit more about the people and the personalities that were involved within this conflict, and play out their adventures on the table. Up as well, which is really cool. So
awesome. Did we mention the Hurricanes and the Mosquitoes?
We did mention the Hurricanes and the Mosquitoes.
I just wasn't listening then. I switched off.
I made a boo-boo because I didn't bring up the seconds.
Ah, you didn't bring up the pictures. Right, yeah. Here's
Hawker Hurricanes.
Your Hawker Hurricanes.
Looking really sweet with Douglas Bader.
Yep.
Ooh, swish.
Is that not Bader?
Bader.
He's badass.
Yep. I'm not trying this one.
Witold Urbanowicz.
That's really important because that's one of the Polish guys that came over to serve in the RAF and flew with the British during the Battle of Britain.
So yeah. Mm-hmm.
These are the ones that came over and took names and kicked ass.
Yeah.
And you've got the Mosquitoes.
The Mosquitoes look fantastic.
Now, the Mosquitoes are a really fascinating plane because they served a huge array of different roles during World War II. Like, I didn't realize, because I just looked at these and thought, oh, they look like tactical bombers.
Yeah.
But there were more than that. There were fighters. They fought in the day and the night. They did surface things. They did a recon of things using photography and stuff like that as well. They were a real workhorse of the Brits during the war.
Very cool.
Awesome. Great collection there. Spectre, I think, are going to make all my dreams come true. Because I think I'm going to get to play the original Arnold Schwarzenegger Predator.
Oh.
Because they've taken it into the jungle.
Yeah.
Oh, dude.
Yeah, so this is a free supplement, and I stress free from the guys at Spectre Miniatures. And as you say, they're going to be taking things into the jungle. This particular sort of scenario booklet, this supplement book, gives you additional rules for playing in the jungle. It allows you to play with new and improved equipment and stuff like that, as well as playing through a linked campaign set in Nigeria between forces from the West against the sort of Nigerian warlords in the area, which is really, really cool. As I say, this is going to be expanded out with another part two, which will sort of tell the story a little bit more. But the really key thing that I think is good about this is that when Spectre Operations first came out, a lot of people were a little daunted by it because there was no real rules for setting up a particular force to fight on the tabletop. You kind of had to sort of play it by eye and sort of work together with someone else as sort of like a cooperative experience. This actually gives you force lists as part of the scenarios. So this will be a very, very, very good jumping off point for someone who wants to get into playing Modern Warfare but didn't quite know how to do it to begin with, because it gives you, like it says, take six men from this sort of faction and like kit them out in this way against this these kind of insurgents and stuff. So yeah, it's going to be very cool for new players as well as those veterans.
It's a good excuse to go and watch Predator again.
It is also a good excuse to go and watch Predator.
Or there is the new one out.
No, I forget the new one. I watched the original. I watched the original.
Is it? Okay, I've not seen it yet.
Just a few weeks back with Anna at home, right? And the whole way through the movie, she's like, this is awful. This is a really bad movie. She totally made it to the end. 3 or 4 days later, I'm upstairs painting away, and she's like doing the dishes or something, and all I can hear is, I ain't got time to bleed.
I ain't got time to bleed! But jungle, the whole jungle warfare is such an incredible arena to place a moderns game in. Because, I saw it on the video game way back, Ghost Recon.
Mm-hmm.
Ghost Recon did some jungle warfare that was really, really well done. Yeah, it's I'm a big fan. That is a big, big step. Right.
Welcome to the jungle.
We have a bit of Stalingrad.
Yep.
Ben? Yeah. So obviously, hopefully, you will have seen Lloyd and John working away on a Stalingrad board for Flames of War, which we used in some of our Let's Plays and stuff. And some of the terrain for you to create your own Stalingrad is now available from the guys at Battlefront and Gale Force 9. So they've created a whole bunch of ready-for-battle scenery sets for you to use. And it's all sort of based around the idea of industrial heartlands and stuff up on the Eastern Front. So you've got a brick-based factory there. You've got destroyed factories, rubble piles if you don't want to make your own rubble mix, like Lloyd showed in the video. And, of course, things like factory chimney stacks, because I love the idea of verticality in games, and having that sense of scale is really important as well. But yeah, you've got loads of really interesting stuff there that you can just go and pick up, slap down onto a gaming mat, and get stuck into some Flames of War as well.
The modularity of them is good though. Like, if you have enough of them to be able to then decide, I'll have a one-story building versus a four-story building, just pop them together and do as you please. It's really cool.
Yeah.
And then do make yourself a bit of rubble mix. It's really easy. Basically,
yeah, go and watch the video and check it out.
In the backstage video, do you guys show how to make the rubble mix? And
I think
stuff like
I describe it and show what the end result is. I don't think I actually film me doing it.
Yeah, but there is some detail on how to do it, yeah?
There's a description,
There's a description, yeah. So don't bother watching that.
We need to get Lloyd to write up a rubble mix cookbook.
I think it was pretty much basically going through exactly kind of where you'd taken them from and then just showing the process of turning it into the sort of dirty terrain that you need for the gaming table, which is cool.
Fantastic. Cool. Right, next week, as you know, and if you don't, you now do, we have a boot camp.
Yep.
We are taking a bolt action into the desert, and we are having a weekend of massive gaming and prizes and fun and entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
So we asked Jim, the historical editor, to put together just a little bit of an overview on what you might expect.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to pass over to Jim, and then after that, we'll be right back to talk about some Kickstarters, some prize winners, and the all-important community golden buttons.
Hello, Beasts of War. This is Ariskany, historical editor for Beasts of War and On the Tabletop, and today's video continues our preparation and ramp-up for the imminent Bolt Action Western Desert Boot Camp scheduled for September 28th to the 30th. Just to set a quick baseline in case anyone's not familiar, Bolt Action is a 28mm World War II miniature skirmish game produced by Warlord Games and Osprey Publishing. The boot camp coming up will focus on some of the new releases they have coming out pertaining specifically to the Western Desert campaign of World War II. Now, obviously, the North African Theater was one of the major theaters in this global conflict, and at the boot camp we'll be exploring some of the campaigns and engagements of the Western Desert and how these battles can be brought to life on the infantry skirmish level in the bolt action system. In preparation for this event, so far we've published a 5-part article series that summarizes the entirety of the North African and Middle Eastern theaters in the Second World War. We've also had a Weekender interview segment and a General's Table Twitch live stream, where we discussed some of the background context, high-level strategy, and what-if scenarios for the Desert War, and how the Desert War affected the overall course of World War II. Now, if this kind of strategic-level narrative interests you, I certainly encourage you to check out these articles and videos, and I hope you find them interesting. But in this video, we'll be focusing on the armies of the desert, narrowing in on that skirmish-eye view of the troops in the Western Desert in 1941 and 1942. So we'll be looking at three major factions here, namely the British Commonwealth, the Germans, and the Italians. For the Allies, some of the troops we won't be looking at here are the Americans. American forces entered the Desert War a little later with the Operation Torch landings in November 1942. Where they fought in Algeria, Morocco, and especially in Tunisia, extending into 1943. Thus, they really aren't in scope for a discussion on the Western Desert Campaign. Now, if the Americans in North Africa is something that really interests you, we do have an article series we ran earlier this year, entitled Baptism of Fire, where we took a 75th anniversary look at Americans fighting in Tunisia. Again, I encourage anyone who's interested to check out those articles. Also, for the Axis, a faction that we won't really be covering here are the forces of Vichy France. While Vichy French units were engaged on the Axis side and fought pretty heavily in places like Madagascar, Syria, and especially in their colonies in Morocco and Algeria, again, we don't really see them engaged in the Western Desert specifically, so we'll be leaving them off the table just for this video. So let's get started with a look at our first faction, the British Commonwealth. When most people think of the British fighting in North Africa, they imagine the iconic 8th Army, the legendary victors of El Alamein. Okay, first, a couple of things. British forces here in the Western Desert were initially a much smaller unit known as the Western Desert Force. This was roughly the size of an understrength corps, with 3 divisions at most in its order of battle. Specifically, this would be elements of the 7th Armored, 6th Australian and 4th Indian Divisions. Later, this would grow into the 13th Corps for battles in mid-1941. 30th Corps would later join 13th Corps to officially form the 8th Army that we all know later in 1941. And finally, 10th Corps would later be added into a reinforced 8th Army for the battles of El Alamein later in 1942. Now clearly, from a Western Desert force with a strength of about 25,000 at most, to a full 8th Army order of battle with a strength of about, well over 200,000, we can see that these forces change out of all recognition depending on where you are in the timeline. So if you're interested in building a historically accurate or a campaign-themed force, consider just a little historical background just to get a focus on what units you might be interested in. Of course, Osprey publishes a fantastic series of books on the subject, or you can reach out to your friendly historical editor here on Beasts of War. He just might be able to help you out. But perhaps the biggest misconception regarding British forces in the desert is simply that they were British at all. Well, over half of them weren't. From the very outset, 2/3 of the Western Desert Force was either Australian or Indian. And when I say Indian, I'm including regiments and battalions drawn from the modern Republic of India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal. Later, we would see brigades drawn from South Africa. New Zealand divisions were also present, and included some very tough regiments of Maori tribesmen. Free French forces fought through many of the toughest battles, including a legendary action at Bir Hakeim and El Alamein, where a brigade of Free Greeks was also involved. Carpathian Poles and Czechs fought during the later stages of the Siege of Tobruk, and there's even a Zionist battalion of Palestinian Jews who fought beyond heroically at Bir el-Helmat in the spring of 1942. Now, the thing to remember with these Commonwealth multinational units is you can build them in 28mm as British. They organized along British orders of battle, they used British weapons and British equipment. The uniforms were also largely British, although some regiments did use different headgear to distinguish their regions of origin. These multinational formations were almost universally infantry units. Now, sometimes these Commonwealth and multinational infantry divisions would have an attached armored brigade, usually built around a regiment of older tanks. This is because the current first-rate tanks were usually reserved for the dedicated armored divisions in 8th Army. So, you can have these Commonwealth infantry and British tanks on the same 28mm table. Just try to make sure that these tanks are of an older model compared to the historical timeline of the battle that you'll be running. British and Commonwealth rifle companies in this period are built on 3 platoons, each with 3 sections of 10 men. This is upgraded from 8 men earlier in 1941. The standard rifle was the Lee Enfield, and each section usually had at least 1 Bren light machine gun. 3 sections put together made about 30 men, plus a headquarters section where you would find a 2-inch light mortar team, additional Bren machine guns, and depending on the date in the timeline, a boys' anti-tank rifle team. So you wind up with a platoon strength about 35, and 3 of these platoons would be bolted together into a company of about 115, plus a headquarters platoon. 4 rifle companies, plus a headquarters company and a support company, are then formed into a battalion, with a bayonet strength of somewhere around 700 men. It's in these support companies that I mentioned is where you find the heavier 3-inch or 76mm mortar teams. You also find engineers, anti-tank sections, and these are usually equipped with the Ordnance QF 2-pounder or 40mm anti-tank gun. For motor transport, we have a mix of trucks and universal carriers. Sometimes these carriers would be outfitted with the Bren light machine gun, or sometimes even a boys anti-tank rifle, making it technically the world's smallest tank destroyer. Okay, a Jagdpanzer it is not, but against Italian CV-33 tankettes or Otto Blinda armored cars, you know, it just might be enough. I don't want to get too much into artillery or tanks here, since that isn't really the focus for bolt action. Suffice it to say that early war British anti-tank guns start off with the 2-pounder that we mentioned earlier. Later in 1942, we start seeing the larger 57mm 6-pounder weapon, and finally at the very end of the Desert War, when the fighting has moved into Tunisia, we finally see the first use of the 17-pounder. An interesting aspect of many of these weapons is that they don't start off with stocks of high explosive ammunition, only solid shot armor piercing. This makes them great for knocking out German and Italian tanks, but it also makes them almost useless against anything you might face in regards to infantry, artillery, or fortifications on your tabletop. I think later on, some high explosive ammunition was manufactured for the 6 and 17 pounder, but in any event, this is something to consider before taking them into your bolt action games. Artillery started off as the 18/25 pounder. This is sort of a hybrid between older World War I era 18 pounder howitzers, modified to fire newer 25 pounder ammunition. This would have filled out batteries and artillery regiments attached to division or brigade units in the earlier part of the war, or in second-line infantry divisions later on in the war. As soon as manufacturing output could manage it, these would be replaced by the superior 25-pounder howitzer. One huge advantage that this weapon had over German counterparts, like the 7.5cm field howitzer, was a much longer range, and this gave British counter-battery fire a much longer punch reach in desert artillery duels. To go over tanks very quickly again, because they're not really the focus here, the British start off with the Vickers Mark VI light tank and the A-13 cruiser tank. For a much slower but heavier punch, we have the Matilda II, sometimes called the Queen of the Desert because it was practically invulnerable to Italian anti-tank fire. In these early battles, the British also made very heavy use of captured Italian tanks. since desert conditions were very rough on the mechanical reliability of their own machines. Later in 1941, we start to see the A-15 Crusader IIs and the Valentine III infantry tanks come in. Later in 1941, these would be supplemented by the first heavy influx of American Lend-Lease tanks in the form of the M3 Stuart, sometimes called the Honey by the British. By mid-1942, the M3 Lee or Grant is coming into the 8th Army service. This is certainly one of the oddest tanks to see widespread service in World War II. And we wrap up with the Churchill Heavy Infantry Tank, used mostly in Tunisia after a handful of them performed very well in the Second Battle of El Alamein. One last note I'd like to make about Commonwealth units in the desert is the question of special forces. There are two that stand out: the Long Range Desert Group and the Special Air Service, or SAS. The Long Range Desert Group started out first. They were mostly a reconnaissance and scouting force of desert survivalists, drawn mainly from New Zealand and Rhodesia, at least at first. Their job was to scout very, very deep behind enemy lines, sometimes for months at a time, by driving hundreds or even over 1,000 miles through absolutely trackless desert. Sometimes they would also strike a high-value target, but usually they were mostly, like I said, reconnaissance and scouting. They would watch and report activity on Axis roads, ports, airfields, and troop deployments. This would change, however, with the advent of the SAS. This is a much more militant and commando-style strike unit, but for all their military training, they often needed the long-range desert group to get them through the desert, behind the enemy, and close to their targets. So, increasingly through 1942 and into early 1943, the SAS and the long-range desert group worked so closely together so many times that it almost starts to become hard to tell them apart, leading to a little bit of confusion among some wargamers today. We'll be covering much more about the SAS and the long-range desert group in our Scorpions of the Desert video segments at the actual boot camp. Now we move to the Germans, and just like we did with the British, before we get stuck too deep into the weeds on the German armies in North Africa, I'd just like to spend a few minutes in general overview and dispelling a few common misconceptions. First off, the Germans are far and away the minority when it comes to Axis forces in North Africa. Man for man, they are always outnumbered, sometimes 3, 4, or even 5 to 1 by their Italian allies. The Deutsches Afrika Korps, or DAK, the German Afrika Korps, never amounted to more than 4 real divisions. In fact, it started out as just the skeletons of 2 partial divisions, 15th Panzer and 5th Light Division, later upgraded to the 21st Panzer Division. Later on, we would see the 90th Light Division join the DAK, and finally the 164th Infantry, along with some additional units like the Ramke Fallschirmjäger Paratroop Brigade. Another misconception that many people have about the DAK is that Rommel was in fact its commander. For the vast majority of its lifespan, the DAK was actually commanded by someone else, usually one of Rommel's subordinate generals. Soon after winning his first victories in Africa, Rommel's DAK was reinforced to become Panzer Group Africa. Rommel then became commander of the Panzer Group, of which DAK was only the central component, of course led then by another general. This would happen again later when Panzer Group Africa was upgraded again to become Panzer Army Africa. Another thing to remember about the German soldier in Africa is that he was almost always very, very sick. Most of the time, German units had a harder time with supply than their Commonwealth opponents, including, most importantly, water. German units usually had just enough water for drinking, with any non-potable water then going into vehicle radiators. Nothing was left for sanitation, which meant that hygiene and health suffered badly. Dysentery, malaria, and jaundice are absolutely rampant among German ranks through most of the Africa campaign, and even troops who were fit for combat were often badly hampered by weakness. Rommel was no exception. His health was absolutely ruined by the desert, and he was frequently back in Germany for medical care for a variety of ailments, and in fact he was absent for the critical outset of the Second Battle of El Alamein. German infantry organization shows important differences from their Commonwealth counterparts at the very lowest levels. They have 10-man squads, the same as the Commonwealth 10-man section, but only 7 of these men in the German squad are actually riflemen. 2 more men make up a dedicated MG-34 light machine gun team mounted on a bipod in a squad support role with an NCO armed with a submachine gun. The volume of sustained firepower that could be expected from an MG-34 firing from 50, 100, or even 200 round linked belts at 900 rounds a minute is clearly much, much higher than anything capable from a Bren gun firing from a 20-round magazine. This is the cornerstone of the German squad's edge and firepower, and thus their ability to maneuver in the face of active enemy units. This is because this increased firepower means that the enemy is easier to pin down. When the enemy is pinned down, it's easier for you to move. More freedom of movement means more tactical options for flanking or assault or envelopment, and this gives the German rifle squad a clear advantage over its opposite number. 4 such squads are put together, plus a platoon headquarters, into a German rifle platoon. There are 3 such platoons in a German infantry company, with one of the platoons also including a section of 5-centimeter mortars. Besides these 3 platoons, a German company also includes a headquarters section and a section of 7.92mm anti-tank rifles. 3 of these rifle companies are typically put together, along with a machine gun company, as you're probably going to be MG-34 machine guns mounted on tripods in the larger battalion support role. And all of this forms together into an infantry battalion. In its headquarters and support element, these battalions are usually supported by heavier 8-centimeter mortars, an anti-tank battery of either 3.7 or 2.8-centimeter light anti-tank guns, engineers, and 7.5-centimeter or even 15-centimeter infantry howitzers, depending on the unit in question. In all, the average German infantry unit, be it platoon, company, or battalion, is bigger, meaner, and deadlier than its opposite number. They have a distinct edge in firepower, maneuver, training in the NCO and junior officer levels, and in equipment. The higher up you go in the command levels, the more pronounced and compounded these advantages become. However, the great equalizer here is that German units are also chronically under strength. What we've listed above is what these units are supposed to have. Actual battlefield strength was almost always much, much lower. German units also had a much tougher time with supply. Fuel was a constant problem, and even those units that could take the field, as we've discussed above, were often very sick. German tanks and other armored vehicles are vastly complicated, and again, with them not really being the focus here, I'll just give them a very quick summary. When the DAK first arrives in Libya in February and March of 1941, we're looking mostly at Panzer Mark 1s, 2s, and some of the early 3s. The Panzer 1 is really barely a tank at all. It only has twin machine guns for armament and was originally intended only as a training tank. The Mark 2 at least had a 2-centimeter autocannon and so could possibly engage British Universal Carriers and Vickers Mark 6 light tanks. The Mark 3, we're talking about mostly the F variant, had a 3.7-centimeter anti-tank gun, which had proved more or less adequate in France, except when they came up against the Matilda II. Finally, we see the early marks of the Mark IV battle tank, with the short-barreled 7.5-centimeter howitzer main gun. This is a high-explosive weapon, and although not very useful against tanks, these weapons are great against infantry, artillery positions, trenches, and bunkers, which, frankly, you're liable to come up against far more often than actual enemy tanks. Later in the Desert War, the Mark III would be upgraded to the G variant with the L-42 5-centimeter weapons, and finally the Mark III-J, or the Mark III Special, with the L-60 5-centimeter weapon. Now, it's the same caliber of weapon, but it's got a longer barrel. And the longer barrel means higher muzzle velocity and thus armor penetration power. But it also means higher recoil, and thus you need larger mounting mechanisms and a much bigger turret. By the time of Alam Halfa Ridge, We're looking at the longer-gunned Panzer IVs. These are the F2 variants. They're finally arriving, followed by a precious few handful of Tigers that show up at the very end of the desert war in Tunisia. As a general rule, German tanks in the desert were lower in quality than similar battalions, regiments, or divisions in Russia, for example, had at the same time. Russian tanks were frankly far more dangerous than British or American models, and so the Germans in Russia always got the better equipment. This left those in Africa to cope with basically second-line gear. Of course, no discussion of the Germans in the desert would be complete without bringing up the 88. As we all know, the 8.8-centimeter Flak 36 was originally an anti-aircraft weapon, but its very high muzzle velocity made it an ideal weapon for engaging tanks when used properly and in careful conjunction with other weapons in your German force. Many war games make the 88 out to be some kind of wonder weapon, but we must bear in mind how vulnerable it is, how hard it is to conceal, what a high-value target it is, and how, in fact, they don't belong to the German army at all. They actually belong to the Luftwaffe, or the German Air Force. Just something to bear in mind when you're taking them onto your table. And now, finally, we move on to the Italians. To my knowledge, we aren't getting any Italian armies at the boot camp, so I'll keep this part of the video rather short. Italian rifle units didn't have any mortar support like the German or British companies at the company level, although they did have two batteries of Brixia Model 35 45mm mortars at the battalion level. Italian machine guns at the squad and platoon level were typically the Breda 30. Now, three of these platoons are built into a company, and three companies are built into a battalion, where additional machine gun sections could be found. Even these, however, were really somewhat light. A 6.5mm in caliber, usually mounted on tripods for a defensive battalion-level support role. Anti-tank guns were a mix of 37mm and 47mm models, although later in the war, there is an Italian 90mm anti-aircraft gun used as an anti-tank gun, much like the German 88. We do see some short-range, direct-fire 65 and 75mm infantry howitzers used for close support in artillery regiments attached around a division level. Italian tanks and armored vehicles in the desert war are really not that impressive. From the CV-33 tankette to the L-6 light tank, then you get into the M-13-39, the M-14-41. These vehicles really are some of the worst used by any power in any of the Western theaters of World War II. There are, however, some Semovente assault guns that are pretty good, including one armed with a 75mm assault howitzer that almost makes it look like an Italian Stug. But generally, Italian armored vehicles in the desert war are actually pretty bad. In general, the Italian soldier gets a very bad reputation in World War II, and honestly, it's a reputation that's not wholly deserved. The Italian nation was promised that it was not going into World War II, and they weren't prepared for it in terms of training, doctrine, infrastructure, or industry. As a result, their unprepared armies suffered terribly when put up against better-equipped foes. The Italian officer corps was also quite bad, with many positions having either been inherited or just outright purchased. Bad leadership and bad equipment is going to lead to disastrous results. When the Germans more or less took over the Desert War in 1941, they could at least partially resolve the leadership issue, and Italian units almost immediately began to perform remarkably better. This was especially true in fixed defense, where Italian positions often guarded the flanks or provided springboards for Rommel's audacious mechanized thrusts. Certain Italian units, like the Ariete and Littorio armored divisions and the Trieste mechanized division, really did exceptionally well, even in the attack, right alongside DAK panzer units. However, the quality of their vehicles and equipment was always going to hold them back to at least a certain degree. So that's going to wrap us up for now, Beasts of War, Desert Warriors. I certainly hope you've enjoyed this quick overview of Armies of the Desert. If you're going to be at the boot camp, I certainly can't wait to see you there. Otherwise, we hope to see you in the live blog, where we'll be bringing you even more Desert War-themed content. In the meantime, watch out for those sandstorms, and thanks very much for watching.
Thanks for that, Jim. Right, on to the Kickstarters. Stay tuned because we've got the Community Spotlight Golden Button Awards coming up, and we're announcing the winner of last week's competition for the Warhammer 40,000 Tooth and Claw. And remember, get your comment in. Oh! I'm still here. Get your comment in. Like and subscribe because we're giving away two copies of Night Vault. Comment here on YouTube and come on over to beastofwar.com. Set yourself up a free account and post a comment.
Oh, I almost forgot. I have an apology to give out during this video.
Oh.
From the live stream.
Uh-huh.
I am sorry that I forgot to turn off my phone. My mom called me in the middle of the live stream.
Oh, mommy always picks the good times to call. Right, Ben, well, time to talk some Kickstarters.
Well, okay.
Just before we get into it, I am concerned that maybe the mass battles have died.
Right.
Just during that wee break there where we were listening to...
Jim.
Jim. Justin walks over there, he grabs the Fallout set and goes, look, Lloyd, look, it's only like 10 figures. That's all you need to
Seven.
Paint. Seven figures. That's all you
seven
need to
Seven super mutants. All that come with
Flash
a little shiny base.
In front of me going, you could be playing tomorrow.
We have a Let's Play out of Fallout, so if you come across thepieceofwar.com...
That's the co-op scenario I was talking about.
Check out the co-op scenario with the AI mechanics and stuff like that.
It works beautifully, I have to say.
Okay, Lost Dragons, Ben.
Yeah, cool. So the first Kickstarter we're going to be looking at is for a series of 3D printable dragons that you print at home. So they're STL files, which is really cool. So you can either print them at home or take them to a fab lab or something like that. This is by Daniel Herrera from 3D Printed Tabletop. And they are creating a whole range of different and very unique looking dragons that you can use in your games, be they large mass battle fantasy games, but who plays those anymore, or in your role-playing games on the tabletop as well. For example, as part of the main pledges that they've got so far, you've got the Magma Dragon, the Ice Dragon, the Fire Twin and the Ice Twin, the Red Guardian and the White Guardian. So they've gone really heavily into both the red and white style dragons that you might know from the likes of Dungeons and Dragons. Yeah. They've also got a very, very cool Kickstarter exclusive forest dragon design. And they're also going to be looking towards a whole bunch of other stuff in the future for a whole bunch of different styles as well. So you've got things like zombie dragons, water dragons, plague dragons and the like too, which is very, very cool. As I say, all of these are available as STR files for you to go and download for yourself. And they actually run a little bit of a YouTube channel where they talk about some of the issues a lot of people have with 3D printing and helping people get stuck into it themselves and give it a go for at home too. So if you really, really like the look of these dragons, but you don't exactly know how you'd even go about starting to print them, they've got a really cool YouTube channel. And of course, there are lots of resources out there on the internet as well. And we have our own forums where we look into 3D printing too, all to help people out with sort of getting used to the idea of, you know, getting these things out on the tabletop themselves and actually having to go with this new technology too. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
Very cool.
So there you go. Get your dragons and a cool YouTube channel as well.
That's awesome. You can never have enough dragons.
Mm.
Dragons are awesome because, like,
love dragons. Best thing in the world.
At the minute, I'm trying to fantasize my stuff a wee bit so I can take it into Kings of War.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking
the Vikings.
I was thinking about getting a dragon, but I got a cockalich instead.
You got a cockalich, yeah.
At least I think that's what it's called. I was lying around the office there last week and I thought, oh, this thing looks amazing. This is like a giant cock with feathers.
Yeah, yeah, I know a cockalich, like a dragon, when I see one. I've had experience of them.
A dragon meat.
So it's I fought one in a dungeon once. So did you have to stab him in the eye, Justin?
I'm fairly sure it's a cockatrice.
Oh, is it a cockatrice?
Yes, I think I'm calling the wrong thing because Ben Googled it. He's like, oh, cockalich.
Yeah, no, a cockalich is...
Let's just say, he didn't get what he wanted.
No, a cockalich is an undead version of a cockatrice.
Oh.
Right.
So it's a, okay. So it's an
like
undead
a
version. Yes, it's one that the skin has started to peel off. You know, it's
so there's no head on it. Like its head's lost its skin and stuff.
Yes.
How do you
raise a cockalich? You just stroke it gently and you say the magic words, man. And works all the time.
Oh, okay.
Dude, I thought you would know how to raise a cockalich by now.
I've never had that problem.
Dragons are great.
For me, my favorite source of dragons is Schleck.
They're awesome. I was looking up them last week.
I love collecting Schleck Dragons. Every time I take the kids to the toy store, they think I'm taking them for them. I'm going for me, because I always go straight to the Schleck stand to see if they have another dragon in their range. I think I've got almost all of them, because I love having versatility in dragons. Well, because it's just amazing.
You missed the Pokemon craze.
Yes.
Schleck Dragons are your Pokemon.
Yes, I want to collect them all, Justin. I want to collect them all.
Has their painting technique gone up? Because I was looking at them recently going, wow, they must have robots digitally painting these or something. Because look at all the detail on this pre-painted stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing. It is amazing. It's the best value dragon that you are likely to buy. Already assembled, already painted, and a great size for 28 mil. Like, I mean a really good size for 28 mil.
Although I do like the idea of companies that are doing dragons for 3D printing, because it's another way to have a look at this new thing for the industry and the hobby.
Yeah, yeah. The 3D printing aspect is good. You know, I'm trying to get back into it again. I got severely disheartened with the 3D printing.
Yeah, because...
It's hard, and I got burnt, and I got injured, and
how many times did you break it?
Many times, but I didn't break it. It broke. There is a difference.
Operator error.
It's not easy.
But there's some amazing 3D printers coming along. You're I sent you a link recently
to the full color 3D printer.
It's got like CMYK plastics, and it mixes it and does full color prints.
I want.
Oh my goodness!
We are not far off, guys. We are not far off. The other option for printing at the moment is there's DLP printers now.
DLP.
So a DLP is a resin bath.
Yeah.
It uses light. Basically like a projector.
Yeah.
Projects a layer at a time, okay, and we are now seeing those printers rocking in at under £500. Those are printers that are capable of printing miniatures, Justin. Well capable of printing miniatures.
I do have to wonder, is there some form of chemical formula that you could come up for that resin that, depending on what color of light you shoot at it, would change the color of the miniature?
You would need a highly sophisticated resin that is photosensitive.
Yeah.
That it activates
would
the
that
different
be the next step.
What you would have is you'd have pigments in there
that
are activated at different wavelengths.
Yeah.
I have no idea how you would go about doing that.
But would that be the next step?
But I bet they could science it, yo.
Yeah. But that would be the next step for me, is getting a printer that's that good and being able to put in a resin that just change that color of the light or the laser or whatever.
I don't know. I think Lloyd's printer's probably got more chance. You know, your kind of additive printer.
Yeah, I think so.
The FDM, because you just load in your three colors and it mixes it and prints it out. You know, the key to that is to get the actual mechanics of it.
Well, it's,
to work
it's,
to give
it's
you the fine
to,
enough resolution
to mix and feed at the correct rate.
That's the easy bit. It's
but it has to mix the exact right amount for each component that it's printing.
Yeah,
and be
it's
ready
but
to
that's
change.
What it's doing.
But inkjet printers are already doing all that.
And that's why I think that's the route to go, because people know how inkjet printers work.
Justin, you have printed something on an inkjet printer.
Yes, yes, yes.
You can print photographic quality on an inkjet printer.
Yes.
We know how to mix colors. Mm. What we haven't cracked just yet is getting the mechanics of the system to allow us to print without that layering. You know, to get that resolution down to be fine enough to get the layering.
But see, with it being printing a 3D object, I'm thinking the mass of each component, it has to be mixing and sending that through at the right rate. As soon as, if something goes off in that, you're gonna have hands that have got color bleed through them.
No, you're not. Well, yes, you are, Justin, but you have to understand that a computer's brain and your brain are not quite the same, okay? In the time that it takes you to blink, right, a computer will have maybe run a million calculations.
All right.
Okay, so the speed at which a computer can work these things out is just incredible. So if you can build the intelligence into the print head, it'll know exactly how much it needs to pull through. I'm not saying it's easy.
Yeah,
it's not easy.
I think it's,
but it's not impossible.
But it's already doing it. I mean, let's talk about, let like. Right, so if computers are going to be able to drive us around in cars.
Yeah.
They're definitely going to be able to print stuff in cars.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yes.
And they're already doing these basic calculations inside inkjet printers and laser printers and stuff so already. So they're already
scaling that.
It's a matter of taking the same kind of thought process. Mm-hmm. There's material science in it because you need to make sure that you can get materials that will actually mix with one another.
Yeah.
But the real key to this, from my perspective, and this is the thing that isn't being solved quick enough. Mm. In the FDM printers is the resolution. We need higher resolution. I don't know what's going
to
be involved
for the actual mechanical moving.
Yeah, so that we get minis that look like minis and they don't look like full of stepping and
Well, I do remember John ordered a thing for a World of Warcraft character of his.
Yes.
He took the 3D model and sent it off to a company and they actually did 3D print a full color version of his character.
It was probably done in the resin bath because you get much higher resolution that way. So all that stuff from Hero Forge and the likes, that's all done using...
This was the pre-color thing. This was years ago, but the colors were not solid. There was bleed through.
Oh, I see. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so it came to him fully colored.
Mm-hmm. But we're kind of in the dot matrix sort of realm at the minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're getting there.
It is getting there.
All right, there. Next Kickstarter.
Next up, we have the Lost Minis. This Kickstarter is really, really piquing my interest. Is this a home for all of the minis that we've never used?
Yeah, so this is the Impact Miniatures guys who are working with a whole bunch of different companies and failed Kickstarters and all kind of things like that. And all of those ranges that were promised that never really came to light, maybe there were things that were done way back in the annals of time in pewter and they never came to light because the sculptors just couldn't get them done. This Kickstarter is aiming to bring those to life. Mm-hmm. So this is over 100, I think, at the moment, miniatures from a whole bunch of different Kickstarters, producers, companies that have closed and all kind of things like that, now brought back to life through this. Now, they were only looking for a very, very small goal. They're already way, way past that now. I think it was $500 and they're up to like $3,600 now at this point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is looking very interesting. And it means that all those projects that maybe never got off the ground, Impact Miniatures are trying to give them a home. Because, of course, a lot of these maybe came with a game or like a board game or something like that, like a big war game or something. But these are sort of just stand on their own miniatures that you could just pick up. And they'll be very, very unique for your collection. So if you like the idea of picking up some stuff from either the worlds of fantasy or sci-fi, this might be something you might want to go and have a look at because you can either sort of dive in all the way and get all the models or sort of pick and choose if you want as well, which is really cool.
So it's a big variety pack.
It's just a massive variety pack of models from all over the spectrum. And as I say, they're all going to be very individual. So, you know, if you want something that's going to look very, very cool for your own character in a role-playing game, this might be something that you might want to go and check out as well. So,
isn't that interesting?
That's kind of cool.
But there's a reason these models died in the first place.
Mm.
But, you know, this is the beauty of what the world is unlocking for us. Both the technology and funding processes like Kickstarter are unlocking niche opportunities like this that something like that could exist. And so, you know, it doesn't matter why the models disappeared. The very fact that people can actually get them, I think it's great. It's great. It's niche of the niche of the niche. I love it.
Exactly.
I'm having a look at the way they've actually laid out their pledges here, which I completely agree with for this type of Kickstarter. So depending on which level you're picking, that's money towards X number of miniatures, and then they've got the pricing on each set of miniatures.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very much what
you can pick
feels,
and choose what you want.
Yeah, it feels like that. You know the way in some game stores you get that bargain bin?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what this feels like.
But
to
wait,
me.
Now, are they actually supplying you physical miniatures?
Yes, from what I can see here.
Yeah.
But this feels like that bargain bin you have.
Sounds like a lot of work. It sounds like a lot of work.
The management for it's maybe going to be a bit of a.
That would be a warning light for me. Like if you've got well over 100-odd miniatures and
the picking process.
These are not things that they're having to create. Maybe these are things that already have molds and stuff made and ready to go.
Possibly. I will also say that Impact have actually run quite a few Kickstarters at this point, and as far as I know, most of them have delivered and they've been okay. I'll put a caveat on it for you to do a little bit of research, but it's worth looking at this one, especially if you see something that looks really cool.
Always be careful.
Yeah,
space worms, they look awesome.
Right. Deep Pit Games have brought Tombed to Kickstarter.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm really quite taken by the artwork on this. Ben, what can you tell us about it?
So this is a really cool little game that's come out from Deep Pit. It's just come funded at this point as well, which is really cool. And the idea is that it's a dungeon delving style adventure, but with a little bit of a twist because it's for 2 to 5 players, where it's set during sort of like the 40s period. So it's a little bit more like Indiana Jones than mm-hmm. it is like a fantasy dungeon crawl that you might be familiar with.
Yeah.
The other really cool thing about this that I thought was really neat is that I love the kind of cartoony style to the miniatures. Of course, they're not going to be like as high-end as a lot of them that you might have seen out there as well, but there are some really neat and interesting mechanics thrown into this mix that really sort of drew it to my attention and made me want to show it off here as well. Once again, you know, be careful with Kickstarters, of course. Mm-hmm. But this one did look really, really cool. One of the really interesting things is that they've really gone for this idea of replayability, because every time you sit down to play this, the Pharaoh is going to be making some very interesting choices as to how they build their pyramid. And depending on the characters that you bring to the pyramid to go delving for the treasures in the tombs and stuff, that will dictate what they can do and sort of what they can spend their time building up, which is really, really cool. The other awesome thing about this is that when you're playing through the different scenarios, the actual map itself changes, like one of the tombs you might see in like Indiana Jones or The Mummy.
Oh, yes.
So rooms can disappear and slide around. Doors mm-hmm. can shut and lock your characters inside them. So you really, really get to play around with this idea of being this malevolent overlord, this pharaoh character in the background when you play this game. The other really cool thing about this as well is that, yes, there's this sort of like one versus many thing going on. So you've got the pharaoh versus the players. Mm-hmm. But they've also thrown into the mix some really nice scenario and cooperative adventures as well. So if you want to get stuck into on that side of things, there's also some options there too. But yeah, give this one a check. Have a look through some of the gameplay stuff they've got there written out on their Kickstarter. As I say, I think the really neat thing about this that drew me to it was the idea of the Pharaoh being able to change the board and play around with the layout of stuff so they can trap people. That might not necessarily mean that the game itself is very good as a whole, but that neat little mechanic was enough to sort of pique my interest, and maybe it can be translated into something else in the future as well, which is really cool. So yeah,
fantastic. Go check it out. Okay, next up to my favorite part of the show, it's Community Spotlight. This is the opportunity where we get to look through our forums and our project systems, mm-hmm. both of which are free. Create a free account and you can manage your projects, mm-hmm. all of your hobby projects via on tabletop.com. So we pick the best, well, we pick what we like in any given week, mm-hmm. and they get a golden button. Who's getting the golden button this week, Ben?
So before we dive into this, I actually just want to say I would really love to see a lot more professional artists and sculptors and things using our system. So if you know anyone that's in the industry, maybe they're a small company or something like that, or whatever, get involved with the project system and show off how you sculpture miniatures, mm-hmm. how you come up with game ideas, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I think it'd be really, really fun to see not only just the community members, but also people in the professional industry working on this too and sort of showing off what they're doing, especially because it allows you to have this really nice immediate feedback about stuff. So if you're interested in showing some stuff off, that could be really, really cool.
I think this is going to be cool. Nightmare Goblins. Yes! Oh, I love them! They're great!
So this is Subadai, who is painting up some amazing looking goblins here from the guys at Nightmare Miniatures. I thought these were absolutely fantastic. Now, you know, I love my old Hammer stuff. I think it's fantastic. I love going back into that kind of retro style of these. They sort of live and breathe old school Warhammer fantasy artwork in these pieces. And I think the way that he's painted them is absolutely fantastic. I love the horrible sort of nasty bone that's attached to these creatures. The sort of not black that's been done for the robes, which is really nice, giving them a kind of night goblin feel. And then, of course, the actual goblin textured skin that he's gone for is really, really good too.
Yeah.
He's gone for this almost deep green, then lit by the lighter green at the top to give them this idea of like cave dwellers, which I thought was really cool. And then when you see it sort of brought across the model and that really nice contrast between the dark and the light, just some really, really fantastic
looking images.
For anybody watching, we clicked into the project and we hadn't realized
it's a bit of a mishmash.
How much work he has done in this project. Here we go.
His project is like a collection of his fantasy stuff.
Yeah.
So he has also done a lot of stuff for like Tomb Kings and all kinds of things like that as well. But the most recent project that he was working on with these goblins, and I'm in a bit of a goblin mood. I'm loving Goblin Quest.
You're gobbling
and stuff,
it
so
up.
Yep. Seeing these was very cool.
Fantastic. Yeah, congratulations, Subadai. Well-earned Lovely golden work. Button on that one. Okay, next up, we have J.R. Aldridge, and this is 7TV Apocalypse Vehicles.
This is cool too. Look at this.
So this is just going back to some really cool kit bashing and sort of bringing together what we love from the idea of things like Gaslands and mm-hmm. what the 7TV Apocalypse is all going to be about, taking those really cool sort of 20 mil matchbox cards and stuff, and then turning them into something awesome for your gaming table. So as you can see here, one of the first images is that fantastic lorry, that massive freighter that he's been working on there, which I thought was really cool. I love the fact that this was effectively a toy to begin with, and now he's turned it into something epic for the gaming table. And as you go down through, you'll see how he's been using lots of bits and pieces from a whole bunch of different ranges. I believe some of these are actually from Crooked Dice's own Apocalypse sprues. So they provide you with a whole bunch of things like meshing and armor plates and gun turrets and stuff, which is really, really cool. Of course, there are other companies out there that are doing similar things. So Ramshackle Games, I believe, or Ramshackle Miniatures actually produce a range of bits and pieces like this that you can use to add onto your matchbox cards and stuff to create them into these sort of weaponized urban, weaponized post-apocalyptic vehicles that you see here, which are really cool. And then as you see towards the bottom, you can see the fact that he's got a whole bunch of toy cars there, as well as some bits and pieces. I believe these old ones on that pink cloth are from Gorka Morka, I think. He's been diving into lots of bits and pieces there, as you can see, and sort of using them to sort of embellish his vehicles and stuff too. So yeah, a really nice thing to see that people are delving into the post-apocalypse and creating some fantastic stuff for their own edification and stuff, which is really cool there.
So, fantastic. I'm eyeing after my own heart as well. I love buying. I've found a great source for what I consider to be cool 28 millimeter scaled articulated lorries. I've found a local cash and carry that's selling off some toys, but they're still 13-14 quid a piece. But it's not too bad, but I just don't have a project in mind at the moment that's coming up to warrant buying them. Right, will we announce our winner?
Yeah.
Okay, before I do that, remember.
Why do you keep putting it so far away?
I should have just left it there, man. We're giving away two copies of Night Vault. If you want to be in with the chance of that, remember all you have to do is comment. There's plenty you can comment about on this particular video. Remember to hit like, hit that subscribe.
And hit the bell.
Oh, yeah, hit the ding my dong. Ding my dong. Remember to ding it, man. And then come across to Beast of War. .com or on tabletop.com, it all comes to the same place of awesomeness, and create yourself a free account and post a comment in there as well. And we do read the comments, and we do reply to most or some of the comments. If it warrants a reply, we'll do our best to get stuck in there. Right, last week we were giving away Tooth and Claw, and our winner on YouTube was AD.
That's it, just A, D.
A space
just
D.
Just A space D. all you have to do now, dude, is come across to ontabletop.com, click the contact us button, no, click the more button, and in the contact us column of that drop-down menu, you will see claim a prize. So get in touch, claim a prize with us, or reach out to us via message on YouTube, claim your prize. Give us your address as soon as possible before Tooth and Claw sell out, and we will get a copy of it bought up and sent over to you. And it would be absolutely our pleasure to do it.
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible. Right, guys, next week, no Weekenders, because we are doing Bolt Action Desert War Boot Camp.
Yes.
I'm excited.
Yep. So coverage should kick off on the Friday.
Yep.
Run through Saturday and Sunday, where everybody's going to be playing a lot of great 28mm games of Bolt Action in the desert.
Absolutely. So come on over, get stuck into that. We're going to be giving away some prizes. We're going to be doing all the usual fun and games that we do during a boot camp. A boot camp isn't just about the people that here. It's about us and you as well. Thank you so much for watching. Thank you to Lloyd and Justin and Ben for joining me this morning. Come and join us tomorrow for the XLBS podcast. I think we're going to have Justin yourself.
Yeah.
I think we'll have Ben back.
Yeah.
We'll get Sam in it.
Give me John. I want John.
Right, we'll get John in it as well.
And I've John and Justin together. John.
Yeah. And
I've named you John.
And no!
And I've got a good hot topic for us to discuss. I've got a good hot topic for us to discuss. And it's related to historical war games.
Perfect. We have John. We'll see you.
Okay.
Nice.
Right. Come across, if you haven't done it already, join backstage, join us in the weekend podcast, and we will see you there. Until next time, have a great week of gaming. Go ahead and check out our other content on screen now, and be sure to check out beastsofwar.com for the latest gaming news and gaming Let's Plays. And while you're at it, why not hit subscribe, and remember to ding our dong. Go on, you know you want to click it. Go on.